Or place your order online. Follow Central Street Farmhouse on Facebook and Instagram. Call 942-4454 or shop online at centralstreetfarmhouse.com.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind. Identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Back on Downtown at 525. Our next guest on the program is a music journalist whose work has appeared in Guitar World, LA Weekly, and Vulture. He's also the author of Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal. And he's the co-author of a new book, Ted Templeman, a platinum producer's life in music. We're pleased to have Greg Renoff join us on Downtown. The book was fantastic, a wonderful read. And the story of how it all started is interesting, too. You got to know Ted interviewing him for your last book, Van Halen Rising, but the name Ted Templeman had kind of been sitting around in your memory since about 1984, it sounds like.
Yeah, when I became a Van Halen fan, I got my start with the 1984 album, and I just loved the way it sounded, and I loved everything about it, and quickly became a big fan and dove back into their catalog. And I, you know, it was one of those things that you started seeing the same name over and over again. Obviously, the guys in the band, but Ted Templeman had produced their previous five albums. And that continued for me in the months that followed and the years that followed. Actually, I remember very distinctly picking up the Eric Clapton Behind the Sun album after hearing it on the radio and looking at the record store. I heard the single, and I think it was She's Waiting, and I liked it. And I was like, oh, Ted Templeman produced this too. Well, I bought that one too. And so, yeah, I was a fan of Ted Templeman. From way back when I was a kid, too, just, you know, tracking sort of the sound of albums. And there were, you know, a number of producers sort of would be ones you would kind of remember that made records you liked the way they sounded. And Ted was always at the very top of that list for me.
And I like the way he explained to his vision of his job to you when he said he thought of himself as a lighting guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting to think about Ted's career, which is laid out in the book, which is that he started off as a in the business, really, as a musician slash vocalist. He became fairly well known through his band Harper's Bazaar. He and four other friends of his from Santa Cruz formed this band, and they were signed at Warner Brothers, and they had a pretty good run of success from about 67 to 1970. And Ted performed on TV. He performed in stadiums with Bob Hope, with Raquel Welch. He played a show with Louis Armstrong at one point. He was on TV with Muhammad Ali, and so they had a really, you know, they had a good run as a pop group that was quite popular. And you know, he talked to me about how, you know, he never really felt super comfortable in the role. He never really enjoyed the spotlight being on him as much as he enjoyed music. And when he had the opportunity to start to learn the ropes in the studio from hanging around while he was making records for Harper's Bazaar, you know, he'd stay after school, so to speak, and learn from the engineers and the producers that he was working with. And and that allowed him to, as you mentioned, transition from that lighting man, where he really was much more comfortable trying to think with artists and collaborate with them about how to make their music more appealing to the public and how to make their ideas grow and develop in the studio and, you know, on them. So that was his mindset.
He played a lot of different instruments. He was a vocalist. He was interested in jazz as a young guy and had a lot of diverse interests. Did that versatility serve him well as a producer?
I mean, I definitely did. I think it's interesting. I mean, even late in the writing process of the book, there's a flugelhorn solo on an album that he did with a vocalist named Nicolette Larson, who had a big hit in 1979 with A Lot of Love. And I was talking to Ted about that song. It just kind of came up, and he said, "Oh, I basically wrote the flugelhorn solo." So he he pulled out his trumpet. He was a trumpet player that night before the studio and kind of wrote out his basic idea for the melody for the trumpet solo, and the flugelhorn player played it. And Ted was actually started off as a drummer and played drums in Harper's Bazaar before he actually stepped out in front of the band and was one of the vocalists, and also was quite adept on piano. So he played organ on a couple of Van Morrison songs, and he played it on a Montrose song. And then, his other instruments really were guitar. He played some guitar too, played some banjo, played some guitar. So yeah, he was a musician through and through, which really did serve him well. He performed on a number of the albums that he produced, uncredited in often cases, but oftentimes in a more famous example is when he played and was credited on What a Fool Believes. He played drums on that track as the band Doobie Brothers were trying to finish off this campaign to finish this song, What a Fool Believes, which they were really struggling to get right. And Ted hopped on the drum kit, and that was the take that actually made the record. And so, yeah, Ted played on a number one hit by the Doobie Brothers, just out of, trying to get those guys to kind of follow along with what he had ideas for a tempo that they weren't quite getting right in the studio. And so it was kind of a fluky thing, but yet he played our number one hit by the Doobie Brothers.
Talking with Greg Renoff here on Downtown. The book is Ted Templeman, A Platinum Producer's Life in Music. I love the story of Ted going to see a session for Frank Sinatra and his impressions of what Jimmy Bowen was doing, or in this case, maybe not doing as producer.
Yeah, I mean, that really was another key moment. Ted talked to me a lot about that night that he saw Sinatra. I mean, you can imagine he was a young kid. He had never made a record before, but he had a deal with Warner Brothers. And so he was hanging around the studio, and Sinatra walked in Hollywood, and Ted kind of followed down the hallway and kind of whispered to one of the engineers, "Can I watch?" And they said, "Yeah, you can watch." He stayed in the back and watched. He said that at that point in time, he really didn't know what a producer did, but he was watching Jimmy Bowen, who was obviously a hit maker. I mean, he was the guy who picked some of Sinatra's biggest hit songs and had a long career as a producer. But Sinatra was Sinatra. He was sort of an unusual example for Ted to see. But he saw this performer, this artist, basically, saying, "Let's take it again." And Jimmy Bowen kind of going, "Let's take it again," because Frank wanted to do it. Frank wanted another take. We're going to do another take. And so Ted was kind of struck by that even a producer, maybe in a situation where you're dealing with the biggest stars in the industry, maybe that's not the right thing to do. That was just his initial impression, thinking kind of the idea of what he thought the producer was to, quote unquote, run the session. But that made a big impression on Ted. Ted also saw Elvis in the studio. Again, that was one of these sort of coincidental things where he happened to be in town, and one of the engineers he knew told him that Elvis was coming in. And this was a little bit later, after Ted was already a pretty successful recording artist in his own right, but he got to watch Elvis record in Hollywood, and he said that was incredible as well. So yeah, those are two big formative experiences for Ted Templeman, to be able to see Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley in a studio situation, sitting in the control room, just kind of watching these sessions. And it was a big moment in his life.
I thought that was very interesting too. And he talked about the professionalism of Elvis and his respect to everybody around him in the studio, the desire to do it right, but not playing the star, just in there being a pro, but nailing it often on the first take too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really something too Ted really talked to me about, which was Ted grew up in the age of the Wrecking Crew. And he actually tells me all the time, "Well, we didn't call it the Wrecking Crew in the 60s, that kind of came later, but that, the records that Ted made as a recording artist were, the instrumentation was almost wholly done by those studio musicians, everyone from Leon Russell to Glenn Campbell, these great, great musicians who would come in after getting the call, and they would sign up and for these 3-hour sessions, and it would record, good vibrations or whatever, but they'd play all the instruments. And so, I think that was a big part of Ted's formative experience as well, to kind of see how these sessions were done in a very professional manner. I mean, it was obviously later on, as the rock era changed, there was a lot more of, like Fleetwood Mac spending 3 months in the studio or something like that. It was, it was actually, they were done on union rate, and there was actually rules about how many songs you could record in a session. They were very regimented with these studio musicians are all part of the union. And so it was, I think that also made an impression on Ted about having to, make studio a place for work. It was a place where you obviously were going to create art and try to have a good time, but it was also some place where it was not a plan to just, waste time or just screw around.
Van Morrison gave Ted a great opportunity to co-produce with him, and Van has always been an interesting, a mysterious guy, but they formed an interesting relationship, and I thought it was a very touching story about Van Morrison going to the hospital when Ted's wife was giving birth.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that's interesting about Van Morrison. I mean, I think Ted, one of the things Ted talks about in the book is he did an interview around 1980 where he joked a little bit about Van Morrison's quirky personality and his penchant for firing people, and it got printed, and Ted felt terrible about that because, you know, Ted always felt that he got on very well with Van, and even if, you know, obviously there were moments where Van was not the easiest person to deal with, but yeah, as you mentioned, he considered Van a friend, and that Van, when Ted's wife was struggling with the pregnancy, the birth of their first child, she was having trouble in labor, Van Morrison actually came down to Los Angeles from San Francisco, flew down to be with Ted and, you know, kind of take his mind off it, and that was, you know, a touching moment for Ted, you know, really kind of getting humanized, you know, the guy who sort of, you know, kind of had a reputation for being a curmudgeon, but was obviously sensitive enough to that situation and to take a plane flight down there to talk to Ted and kind of spend time with him. So yeah, Ted really did have a lot of great things to say about Van Morrison. And, you know, I think it'd be the thing if Van ever heard this interview or anything else that Ted would write about in the book, I think Ted really tried to make clear that he was great. Van gave him a chance. You know, Van Morrison at that point was a big star, and that Ted was at his very first opportunities to produce, and, you know, Van and Ted kind of hit it off over their mutual interest in jazz music, and Van gave him a chance, and they ended up hitting it pretty big with Wild Night. That was a big hit for Van, and really Ted's first hit as a producer. So Ted's very, very grateful for everything he learned and for Van for giving him a chance.
One of the great successes of Ted's career and one of the enduring relationships was with the Doobie Brothers. What did he hear in that biker band that made him think they could be successful?
You know, I think it's interesting. He heard the songs. I mean, I think that was what comes down to too. There's always, for Ted, it was always two things. It was always the songs, the quality of the songs, and I think that's kind of obvious. But for Ted, one of the things he taught me in writing this book with him was about distinctiveness, especially with singers. It could be with guitar players and other instruments too, but for vocalists, particularly on the pop radio, when he heard the Doobie Brothers sing on their demo tape that Ted heard as a tape listener at Warner Brothers, he thought they had these really great, interesting two-part harmony sound, which he thought was kind of unique. They had just something a little bit special. He said it kind of reminded them later years. He kind of compared it a little bit to the Eagles, obviously not as maybe as elaborate as the Eagles harmonies, but it had that same sort of thing that kind of sticks in your ear. And they went and Ted was able to take a fellow Warner Brothers producer, the guy who produced Harper's Bazaar with them, to Santa Cruz, and it was even more interesting because they saw this band for the first time. They laid eyes on them, and they were a biker band. They were playing for Hell's Angels, and yet they were singing these very angelic, almost Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young style harmonies while wearing leather and chains and these heavy black boots. And so Ted thought that was an interesting contrast as well. But for Ted, it was the song, you know, the songs that he heard on that tape that he thought, wow, these guys are really talented. And then even more so when he saw the image and heard the vocals live, he thought this is a really great band. And of course, they went on to be super successful.
Really surprised to read the story of Blackwater that began as a B-side and then finally decided to release it when other singles on the album didn't do as well as they hoped. And he kind of went back into some of the vocal work, the a cappella work, and the arrangements that have been used back in the Harper's Bazaar days to create what you guys point out in the book is really the big hook in that number one song.
Yeah, that was another interesting conversation. I had a number of these with Ted about picking singles, and he talked about how, you know, he had a sort of a mixed record on that. I mean, I think the thing is, that was something that Ted mentioned, that one of the first lessons he learned as a burgeoning producer was from his mentor, Lenny Walker, who produced so many big records for Warner Brothers and later on went on to become the president of Warner Brothers, that told Ted, like, don't stick your albums full of filler. In other words, there was a tendency, especially in the 60s, to have like the one hit and then you just pack the album with another songs that were just kind of throwaways that were known as filler. And that continued into the later years as well. But Lenny really impressed upon Ted, like, get the good songs on the records because you never really know for sure what the best song is going to be in a single. Sometimes it can be a surprise to you. And that was what happened with Blackwater, which was that Blackwater was this little acoustic song, as you mentioned, with this a cappella part in the middle of it. And Ted just didn't think it was, you know, he heard it, he just didn't think it was a radio song. I mean, he thought it was a good song. He put it on the record, but he didn't think it was a radio song. And yeah, so it was the B-side of the first single off that record, which usually is a indication that that's the weakest song on the album in terms of marketability. And so, yeah, Ted had to, you know, point out a couple times, he would just joke to me, he goes, well, you know, Basically, his track record was mixed. He obviously had a lot of success with some singles he picked. You know, "Dance the Night Away" by Van Halen, for example, was a big hit. That was obviously the first single off that album, Van Halen 2. And, you know, "You Really Got Me" by Van Halen, another big hit, their first single. But other ones, he said that was interesting because it actually took off kind of organically on radio. Just DJs flipped the single over and said, "Oh, this is a good song. We'll start playing this." And, you know, before you knew it, it had spread across the country. So, yeah. But, of course, that's the type of mistake that you'll own for the rest of your life, is the number one hit.
The book also dispels the notion that some fans have that Tom Johnston and Michael McDonald were some sort of arch rivals. There was actually a great deal of respect and admiration between them.
Yeah, I mean, that's really was something that I was a little bit surprised about. I never gave it that much thought, but I kind of always expected that was the case. That was more of the popular narrative. And, you know, Ted said that they always were very respectful to each other and cordial. And, you know, I think Mike McDonald, I've never spoken to him personally, but from the way Ted explained it, is that Mike kind of always felt as if he was stepping into the shoes of Tom Johnson and had such huge respect for Tom. Because Tom, you know, to Mike McDonald in 1975, 76, it was Tom Johnson that built the Doobie Brothers. It was China Grove. It was Long Train Running. It was all these great hits that Tom had written and was kind of the distinctive voice of the Doobie Brothers. And so, you know, there was this real mutual respect. And then from Tom's perspective, he certainly understood that Mike was stepping into the band because Tom was ill and couldn't play. It wasn't sort of, he was, you know, some sort of hostile takeover of the band. It was just a thing where they needed somebody to kind of jump in there to front the band. And Ted always talked about to me how much he liked it was kind of a handful of times that Tom and Mike played on the same track, that he just, you know, he wanted to be one big family and just said, okay, now we've got another guy who can sing. It's great. You know, the Doobie Brothers had been a band that had kind of had worked on that dual lead vocalist to some extent because Pat Simmons always did a couple lead vocals every album, two or three songs Pat would sing. And so there was always this kind of diversity of voices. You had Tom out in front as the most prominent of those, but, you know, it didn't work out for Tom staying in the group. And it was difficult for Ted because Ted, as he mentions in the book, felt like, in part, you know, obviously, you know, a huge part of the Doobie Brothers' success for Ted, too, was from Tom's hit-making ability as a writer and stuff like that, and performer.
Well, the Van Halen story is a fascinating one as well. And one of the stories from the book that's gotten a lot of attention from reviewers is the story of what almost happened at the beginning of the band's start, that David Lee Roth might not have been there to begin with. It could have been Sammy Hagar from the get-go.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, from Ted's perspective, he looks at that and he thinks about how it would have been the biggest mistake in rock history. And I think that kind of gets lost in the shuffle because the rest of the story is, you know, a little bit more titillating. But yeah, it's true. Ted heard Van Halen in a nightclub in Hollywood and loved the band, and particularly was taken by Eddie Van Halen's guitar playing. I mean, that was really what sealed the deal for him. But he thought the band had good songs and, you know, they were a good live band. But when he got Van Halen in the studio to do a demo session, he was a little bit worried about Dave's vocals. It was something where he didn't think Dave necessarily was going to be able to hold up under the bright lights of the studio, that he wasn't going to be able to do it. Maybe where if you tried to make a record with him, it was going to cause problems where he wasn't going to be able to pull it off. But, you know, as Ted mentions, you know, in a matter of whatever, a few weeks after mulling over this idea, well, maybe I could give Sammy Hagar a call. And Ted really has been adamant about the fact that was something he told only to his engineer and was just something he was just really thinking about because he wanted to give it more time to see what was going to develop. But, you know, Dave really won him over. And, you know, he did a complete 180 on Dave, where he thought that, you know, the writing, the lyrics were so amazing, and Dave's personality and all the things we associate with David Lee Roth, and that there were, you know, there was vocal talent there. It just needed to be, you know, for, to use a football analogy, to be coached up. And that's what Ted set out to do, was to coach Roth up about, you know, here's what we're going to do. Here's what you do well, and we're going to really, really focus on those things, and we're going to make those things the David Lee Roth vocal approach. And, you know, Ted had been, as I mentioned, quite a successful singer himself and was the right guy to spend time with Roth and spend a lot of time with him, and it worked out great. But, yeah, it's, you know, I think, yeah, Ted would kind of point to the fact that, you know, it went from being a you know, sort of a something that he was mulling over to immediately, you know, within a matter of weeks, he was immediately struck with the fact that this would have been a terrible idea. You know, this is the guy. This is the right guy for the band.
And he still thinks that, perhaps their biggest hit, Jump, was way too pop for a band that he thought of as a rock band.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was something, too, that for Ted, you know, Ted was trying to think about what was basically what he felt to be the band's identity, which was sort of, you know, a hard rock band that wrote radio-friendly songs. And for him, when he heard the Jumps song idea, he was just thinking he was too far afield from that. And was also, I think, really, really stuck on the fact that he thought that Eddie Van Halen is one of the best musicians in the whole world. And he talks about, he compares him to Charlie Parker in the book, and he will tell you that he thinks he's one of the three greatest musicians of the 20th century. And so he kept thinking to himself, why would a guy who's this good at guitar be playing keyboards? Like, he should just play guitar. And it wasn't about the guitar hero aspect as much as it was much more that he just felt that there was such a singular voice on the instrument, something so magnificent, you know, maybe like a Louis Armstrong or something like that. So, like, why would Louis Armstrong play the piano when he could play the trumpet like he could play it or something like that? I mean, it was just that type of thing for Ted. And so he was lukewarm about the idea, especially because it was so such a keyboard-driven song. But as Ted says in the book, he freely admits that, you know, he admires Ed for sticking with his idea and kind of basically convincing Ted, like, you know, you got it wrong, I've got it right, let's go forward and do this song. And then the song came together. And, you know, I think something else that's kind of gotten lost in the shuffle, too, that Ted really tried to make clear to me was that, you know, he liked the song as a pop song. He thought, this is a cool song. He just thought it's not the right song for Van Halen to do. He didn't think. But, of course, you know, it turned out to be a number one hit, and it was a game changer for Van Halen. And Ted gives all credit in the world to Ed Van Halen for seeing his vision through to the end.
A lot of highs in the book, a lot of lows as well. And I think one of my favorite stories is when he was trying to get Cheech and Chong signed to Warner Brothers.
Yeah, that was a funny story. He didn't tell me that right away. I don't remember when he told me that. It was sort of maybe halfway the book process. And as soon as I heard that story, I was like, well, that one's got to go in the book. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, it's interesting. Ted went from being a guy who in 1967 was on the cover of magazines, and they were, you know, they were minor stars and had a top 10 hit, to by 1970, where he was just a, you know, basically like a grunt for Warner Brothers. He was a tape listener, which meant that he went to this windowless room inside of Warner Brothers headquarters and sat there and just listened to tapes all day. And he also tried to, you know, kind of prowl around on the Sunset Strip and just see what was around. Just, you know, you're trying to basically prove that you could have an ear for talent. And he saw this band of the Troubadour, the band, this comedy act called Cheech and Chong. He just thought this was the greatest thing ever. He thought these guys are great. And yeah, and then he went to the big A&R meeting and got the opportunity to say something. And Mo Austin, who's a legend in the music industry, and Frank Sinatra's right-hand man, basically, at the record label, said, okay, all right, you like this group, Ted? We'll go check them out. And then when Ted called to say, hey, good news, guys, we're gonna send a guy from Warner Brothers down to see you guys at the Troubadour, one of the guys in Cheech and Chong informed Ted that they were too late, that they were already signed to A&M, so Ted kind of had to have his tail between his legs so that I can go back and tell the boss that, oh yeah, we're late. You know, we missed the boat on those guys.
And hard to believe, too, that Ted contemplated leaving the music business in 1970.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of those really, those interesting, you know, hopefully people who pick up the book will take some sort of lesson away from that. I mean, I think that's a really important moment for any person, you know, where you feel discouraged, where you say, well, I know I've had all this, I've been a musician my entire life and I've been successful at it and I love it, but you know what? I just can't pay the bills and it's not working and no one's giving me a chance. And yeah, you know, it's really amazing because Ted thought about being a school teacher or being a book salesman clerk. You know, he was, you know, he's a very educated person. He graduated from Santa Clara University, and so college educated guy. But yeah, as I said at the end of the book, when I did my afterword, I said, aren't we all glad that Ted didn't decide to sell books for, you know, for a career? I think we're all glad that he didn't decide to become a school teacher. You know, he might have been a good teacher, but would have missed out on a lot of stuff.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and he really seems like an interesting and comes across as a very decent guy throughout the book as well. So I really enjoyed reading it, and it's been great to talk with you about it. Greg, thanks so much for being with us, and we wish you much success with the book.
Pleasure. Really enjoyed the conversation. You guys have a great night. Thank you.